Donc maintenant, je vais passer la parole donc à David Phillips pour nous éclairer sur la politique américaine vis-à-vis de la Turquie. Que va-t-il se passer, David?
Thank you very much. My father was a businessman in New York, and he always told me, it's much harder to give a 10-minute speech than an hour-long speech. In the interest of brevity, I don't want to miss the opportunity to commend Kindal Nezin and the Kurdish Institute of Paris. As you pointed out, we've collaborated for almost 30 years now on a whole range of issues, and I have very high regard for the Institute and for you personally. So thank you for your invitation today. Before talking about U.S.-Turkey relations, I do want to push back a little bit on the last statement that Mithat Çankar made. I think it is a mistake to treat business as usual. Mrs. Merkel shouldn't be going to Ankara with her hat in hand. The European Parliament should specifically lay out the criteria for more normal relations. And unless those criteria are met, members of the European Parliament and European political leaders simply should boycott Turkey and should not continue to pretend as though there's no problem. If we continue to do business as usual, we will accomplish nothing while more people are killed. And in my view, this is a dereliction of political responsibility and a failure of moral leadership. So let me now speak to the topic of which I was assigned, which is U.S.-Turkey relations. I'm going to try in my remarks to address the prospects of improving relations between Turkey and the United States during the administration of President Donald Trump. It pains me to say that those words, but that's the reality. Those are the conditions that we are living with. I can say that for 30 years, I've worked as a policy maker and trying to influence policy as a senior advisor in the U.S. Department of State under three different presidents, as a public intellectual. Right now, we are at a point of remarkable political transition, not only in the United States, but also in Turkey with its pending referendum on April 15th. In Europe, a series of elections where ultra-nationalists are making gains. So I have always felt that it was in my capacity to understand and to shape events. I feel as though I'm less empowered now than in the past, because so much is volatile and is fluid. But I'll try to share with you what I think are the primary issues between the U.S. and Turkey as a way of framing what the U.S. can do to advance the Kurdish cause. And then, because I'm a very practical guy, I'm going to conclude with some recommendations of steps that can be taken that I think will have impact. I'm going to look at the potential areas of agreement between the U.S. and Turkey. I'm going to consider flashpoints in U.S.-Turkey relations. These flashpoints include Turkey's demand for the extradition of Fethullah Gulen and Turkey's demand that the U.S. discontinue its security cooperation with Syrian Kurds. Tayyip Erdogan and Donald Trump had their first telephone call on February 7th. The call was marked by high hopes and mutual admiration. The White House indicated that the two discussed their, quote, shared commitment to combating terrorism in all its forms. Trump, quote, reiterated U.S. support to Turkey as a strategic partner and NATO ally and welcomed Turkey's contributions to the campaign against the Islamic State. Trump and Erdogan avoided contentious issues. Trump did not criticize Erdogan for the mass arrests and dismissals that followed the attempted coup of July 15. Erdogan did not mention Trump's Muslim ban on travel to the United States. They found common ground in their disdain for the media, with Erdogan praising Trump for putting a CNN reporter, quote, in his place during the news conference the day before. They discussed details of the visit to Turkey by newly approved CIA Director Mike Pompeo. The following day after Pompeo's visit, Vice President Mike Pence promised a, quote, new era in U.S.-Turkish relations. Erdogan invited Trump to visit Turkey. Now, despite this happy talk and this surface-level agreement, substantive rapprochement between the U.S. and Turkey is more problematic. Erdogan has red lines. He wants Trump to reject Pentagon proposals to arm the YPG and YPJ in Syria. Erdogan insists that the PKK and the PYD are one and the same. However, the U.S. considers and treats the PYD legally in different terms. The issue of Fethullah Gulen is also contentious. Erdogan makes clear that Gulen is considered an enemy of the state. But extraditing Gulen is not a political decision. It's a strictly legal decision. Despite the new, quote, evidence that Turkey has provided, I don't believe there is information in those boxes that warrants the extradition of Fethullah Gulen. I don't see how an aged preacher in Pennsylvania was responsible for the coup, even if Gulenists were involved. And besides, even if the Justice Department views the extradition favorably, Gulen has legal recourse. The Justice Department must decide based on the evidence. If it recommends extradition, a U.S. federal court must decide. Gulen can contest extradition and appeal if he loses. This process will take months, if not years. So if Erdogan is looking to placate Turkish public opinion in short order, it simply isn't going to happen. We should also remember the fact that Gulen and Erdogan are old partners, and their partner was based on reshaping Turkish society. It was also based on money and corruption and sharing revenues from gold that was being smuggled and the proceeds skimmed for Turkey to provide money to support ISIS operations and for Gulen to put money in the pockets of customs and police officials who are Gulenists. So this issue is not easily resolved. It isn't going away easily. And Reza Zarab, who was conducting those smuggling operations, was arrested coming to the Miami airport. He's now detained at the Manhattan Correctional Center. If he provides information on his relations with Erdogan and Erdogan's inner circle and family members, including the billions of dollars that was being skimmed to provide assets to ISIS, that's going to be an extremely embarrassing and political liability for Erdogan himself. Let's talk about Raqqa. So far, the YPG has acted as the U.S. ground force in Syria. After the heroic defenders of Kobani were able to beat back ISIS, the YPG took the border crossing at Tal Abyad, which was along the jihadi highway, which was used by Turkey to transfer fighters, weapons, and money to the Islamic State in Raqqa. We should also recognize that in Kobani, the U.S. made a political decision not only to support the YPG, but a combined force that included YPG, PKK, Pajak, and Peshmerga from Iraqi Kurdistan. The U.S. is currently continuing its cooperation with the YPG through the Syrian Defense Forces. But let's be real. The YPG has 40,000 fighters under arms. The Syrian Defense Forces maybe constitutes a few thousand. The SDF is just a fig leaf that the U.S. uses so it can tell Erdogan that it's not providing weapons directly to the Syrian Kurds. Former President Barack Obama's national security team developed a battle plan to attack Raqqa. Top U.S. military commanders pushed for directly arming the YPG. Then Defense Secretary Ash Carter backed the plan. So did Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff Joseph Dunford and Army General with responsible for U.S. forces in the Middle East, Joseph Votel. In December of 2016, Dunford and Carter submitted a formal proposal to arm the Kurds with armored vehicles, anti-tank weapons, machine guns, and mine-clearing equipment. Unfortunately, and true to form, the Obama administration was overly deliberative. They took too long to make that decision. By the time they formally requested weapons be supplied to the YPG, it was just a few days before the inauguration of Donald Trump. And the Trump transition team rejected the plan. They said it lacked details about how many U.S. troops would be required, where the training would take place to help the YPG with their new munitions. Trump was dismayed that there was no provision for coordinating operations with Russia and no clear political strategy for mollifying Turkey. Nor were there contingency plans if the Kurdish attack stalled, and Trump rejected the plan. He gave Secretary of Defense James Mattis 30 days to present a plan that would, quote, utterly destroy ISIS. Somebody was listening to this. So, the plan is due by the 28th of this month. And it must consider some very important questions, whether the U.S. decides to arm the Kurds and support the YPG, questions of establishing safe zones in Syria, and proposals for increased autonomy in Syria are all flashpoints in U.S.-Turkey relations. Trump said he'll absolutely do safe zones for Syria. He called them big, beautiful safe zones. But establishing safe zones is a serious decision with consequences. The U.S. has to consider where will safe zones be established, how will the zones be enforced, and which local fighters will it work with and rely on. For sure, safe zones have some substantial benefits. They'll shrink the territory controlled by ISIS. They'll be a launch point for rebel groups fighting ISIS. They'll help mitigate the humanitarian crisis, serving as a sanctuary for displaced Syrians. But there are also costs to safe zones. They'll require significant military assets. U.S. troops will be in harm's way. Enforcing safe zones also risks putting the U.S. on a slippery slope of further involvement in Syria's civil war. It'll require increased deployment of U.S. special forces and air power. Deconflicting U.S. and Russian warplanes is also going to be required. And of course, military decisions like this don't occur in a vacuum. They go hand in hand with a decision about U.S. diplomatic engagement. So far, Russia and Turkey have sought to exclude the U.S. from talks aimed at ending Syria's civil war. the collapse of the peace conference in Astana on January 24, which was backed by Russia and Turkey with Iran, showed the limits to Russian-Turkish diplomacy and the indispensable role of the U.S. in mediating and enforcing a peace agreement. The recent friendly fire incident, in which three Turkish special forces were killed by Russian warplanes, underscore the fragile nature of Turkish-Russian rapprochement. If the U.S. is going to be true to its word, it can establish a safe zone on the border with Jordan, working with local fighters that are called the Southern Front. If the U.S. chooses to establish a safe zone in Syria along the border with Turkey, it could work with the YPG, which would exacerbate tensions with Turkey, which has staked out its own zone of influence by illegally invading and occupying the area around Jarablus. If the U.S. decides to focus its cooperation on the YPG, Ankara will view this as American support for a nascent Kurdish state protected by the U.S. the same way the U.S. protected the Kurdistan region of Iraq. We recently heard at a press conference yesterday Donald Trump float the idea of U.S. ground forces being used to create this safe zone and be the point of the spear in Raqqa. We need to see how serious he is. It's much easier to get into a war than to get out of one. U.S. cooperation with the YPG is battle-tested, and it should continue. So let me talk about autonomy. Even though the PYD was excluded from the Astana talks, Sergei Lavrov invited a delegation of Syrian Kurds to Moscow for a conference a few days later. Lavrov presented a draft constitution for Syria, including restrictions on power of the Syrian presidency, most powers relegated to a parliament, and a newly created assembly of regions. The constitution, presented by Russia, stipulates equal rights for Kurds and Arabs. Russia also invited discussion of autonomy for Kurdish regions, which is a step towards federalization and confederalization between Rojava and Iraqi Kurdistan and other Kurdish regions. Erdogan will be incensed if Putin endorses decentralization, and he'll be even more pissed off if the U.S. and Russia come together and endorse that as a sustainable constitutional arrangement going forward. Ankara quite simply views constitutional power sharing as a step towards fragmentation and independence. Remember how Ankara castigated the Kurdistan region of Iraq for years, and now they have had a warming relationship with President Barzani and the KRG. Ankara fundamentally fears that independence or federalism for Kurdish entities will inspire the Kurds in Turkey to seek the same. If Trump goes along, this will widen the gap between Turkey and the United States. So in conclusion, let me just reflect historically, as Mithat did, that Turkey has a tradition of blaming great powers for their internal problems. As popular support for Erdogan erodes, which may occur in response to deteriorating economic conditions, Erdogan will look to blame others for Turkey's plight. Blaming the United States would affect U.S.-Turkish relations, casting doubt on their security cooperation. Turkey's siding with Russia would further erode Turkey's standing in NATO, and questions about Turkey's suitability as a member of the North Atlantic Alliance would in turn deepen divisions in Turkish society and polarize Turkish politics. So I promised that I would offer some practical suggestions. Let me do that briefly because I want to make sure that our last speaker has plenty of time. There are lots of criteria for states to become members of NATO. It has never occurred that a member of NATO has gone rogue, like Turkey has. And there is no process for evicting a member. Quite frankly, NATO is not just a security alliance. It's a coalition of countries with shared values. And Turkey has shown through its Islamism, its egregious abuse of human rights, its anti-democratic actions, that it is not suitable for to be a member of NATO. Since there's no process for throwing Turkey out, what I recommend is that NATO establish a compliance review committee. And the committee would evaluate whether countries that are member states of NATO, through their domestic politics, are complying with the criteria that got them in the first place. And if they have a failing grade after 2 years, then they would be suspended from the alliance. We know Turkey has a fragile economy. It's now 4 Turkish lira to the dollar. GDP has been crashing. Turkey can't borrow money the way it used to. And frankly, political support for Erdogan is based on cheap, easy money that Turkish businesses and the Anatolian tigers are taking advantage of. So I believe that European economists and American economists should set up a committee in order to evaluate Turkey's economy and see what steps it can take to put pressure on Turkey's economy so that either it reforms or Turkey's bubble is burst, leading to serious questions about Erdogan's competence in running the economy. Erdogan is a war criminal. There needs to be accountability. Under the Rome Statute, which set up the ICC, it'll be difficult to have that within a UN framework. But within the Council of Europe, where Turkey is a member, it is possible to establish a committee to investigate Turkey's noncompliance with the Geneva Conventions and establish recommendations for accountability, holding its military and political leaders accountable. And the French Assembly and other assemblies in Europe should pass resolutions calling on the Council of Europe to set up an investigative committee as part of the broader cooperation envisioned Europe-wide. I frankly think it's crazy that Kurds in the region don't get along better. There's been talks about a Kurdish Congress that would be inclusive for years. Why can't Kurds get together at this critical moment in Kurdistan's history and talk about their shared interests and work more cooperatively together? Just because Kurdish leaders may have different ideologies or pursue different political agendas shouldn't prevent there from being a Kurdish Congress that promotes Kurdish unity. One of the things that I'll be talking about in Erbil tomorrow is the specific topic of promoting Kurdish unity. We heard earlier about the mayor's solidarity and that you've arranged, I think, 76 mayors to sign a petition. I don't know if the mayor of New York City is on your list, but if he isn't, let me know. I'm a constituent. I'll call the mayor and ask him to sign on.
Me too.
There's some other mayors in Athens and Thessaloniki who I'm sure would be agreeable.
Sure.
And the American Jewish Committee recently had hundreds of mayors sign on to a petition condemning anti-Semitism. I would look at that list of mayors and approach them. So let me say one word in passing. And I say this reluctantly because I've always thought that the solution to the Kurdish question lies in the deeper integration of Turkey into Euro-Atlantic institutions. Well, given the trends in Turkey and the recent resolution by the European Parliament, I just don't see that happening. When I interviewed Marty Ahtisaari, the Nobel Peace Prize winner for my book on Kosovo, he said that Slobodan Milosevic lost Serbia's claim to govern Kosovo because there was a consistent pattern of human rights abuses. Well, I submit to you that Tayyip Erdogan has lost his claim for Turkey to govern the Kurdish regions because of the crimes that he's committed. And instead of trying to placate Erdogan and make nice with Erdogan and hope we can persuade him to play along, it's time for the Turks, for the Kurds in Turkey to think about whether or not independence is the right move. Only dramatic gestures with political support is going to move the center of gravity on this discussion forward. I can't tell you what to expect from the United States, but I can assure you that the Friends of the Kurds in Washington and myself will continue to advocate for the kinds of measures that we've talked about today. Kendall, thank you for inviting me.
Thank you.